Hello and welcome, history friends, patrons all, to 1956, episode 2.16. In the last episode, we continued to trudge through our analysis of affairs both at home and abroad, and we also looked at how they were connected. In the face of the unfolding crisis, as opposition and frustration grew among his peers in the United Nations and in the American government, Anthony Eden continued to march towards his destination. By the 4th of November 1956, the Egyptian Air Force had been destroyed and Israel had effectively achieved its military targets before adhering to the Anglo-French ceasefire ultimatum of the 31st of October. A flotilla now approached Port Said in the opening of the Suez Canal, as Operation Musketeer was brought to life following months of planning. By now it was a plan which several key figures were attempting to cancel or work their way out of, but Eden believed that there was no going back. So it is to this troubled, weighted scene which we will now take our narrative on the 4th of November, 1956. The red light flickered on, and absolute silence was observed in the room. It was Sunday, the 4th of November, and a chill had set in outside. The day had been full of further surprises, to the extent that the leader of the opposition had decided that enough was enough. Hugh Gaitskell had torn into the Conservative government over the last week, as more and more information regarding exactly what had been done in Egypt, and in league with whom, began to leak out. Hugh Gaitskell was now certain that Eden had lied to him, and while it wasn't necessary for a government to consult the opposition before moving, Gaitskell would have expected, as would many of his peers, that in such delicate times as these, Eden would have let the Labour front benchers know what he was up to before the invasion was launched. And yet, Eden had not done this. By failing to keep Gaitskell appraised, Eden guaranteed that the Labour leader would adopt the worst possible interpretation of the Prime Minister's policy. Not that there were many good interpretations to be had. Gaitskell cannot have been ignorant of the rumours that Eden had attempted to have his radio broadcast cancelled either. In the background, Eden continued to try and use the few old friends he had had in the BBC to effect a kind of censorship not seen since the Second World War. But this wasn't the only reminder of those dark days of a decade before. Gaitskell opened this speech over the radio by referring to a tragic, terrible week, by far the worst week for the world and for our country since 1939, before adding, "Make no mistake about it, this is war. The bombing, the softening up, the attacks on radio stations, telephone exchanges, railway stations, to be followed very, very soon now by the landings and the fighting between ground forces. We're doing all this alone, except for France. Opposed by the world, in defiance of the world. This is not a police action. There is no law behind it. We've taken the law into our own hands. That is the tragic situation in which we British people find ourselves tonight." Anglo-French efforts to call the intervention into Egypt a police action was a deliberate act. Look at us, intervening to defend the interests of an entity, just like the United States did for South Korea. Of course, the British and French governments were not acting as the United States had done then, and whatever one's feelings on the usage of the term police action during the Korean War, Eden didn't have a leg to stand on when he tried to use it here, and he knew it. Not only did he know it, but so did several rungs of British and French administrative and military personnel who were forced to cloak their action in a certain way to the waiting press. By classing it as a police action, Britain and France could insist that they were not in a state of war with Egypt, and thus the United Nations did not need to impose any kind of sanctions upon them or to interfere generally. Both these ideas would be shattered as the days went on, though. The first idea to go was the idea of a police action, an already flimsy idea in the first place. James Cameron, not of the Titanic fame, but in this case a war correspondent in Cyprus, had the chance to pose questions to the Anglo-French commander-in-chief, Sir Charles Keighley, just before the flotilla left for Egypt. The notion of police action had always grinded Cameron's gears, as this hilarious memory of Cameron's shows. "I said, well, I'm buggered if I'm going to call it a police action. I'm going to call it a war." And Keighley said, If you do, we'll hold up your reports forever, which they did. But then, during a press conference, Keighley himself used the expression limited war. So I said, I see it as a war at last. No, it is not, said Keighley. But you just said it was. Did I? Asked Keighley. Did anyone else hear me say that? Yes, shouted about 200 correspondents. The general never used the words limited war, insisted his staff. Yes, he did, insisted the correspondents. Well, if you think this is a war, General Keighley concluded amiably, you'll bloody well have to prove it. And he left. So I decided to leave too, to go back to London where I could call a war and really blow my top. But they wouldn't let me. They kept me here in Cyprus until it was over. Eden had been waging a battle of sorts with the press and relied, as I alluded to, on several old mates he had in the BBC, on the expectation that a kind of World War II era Ministry of Information could be set up and used to control what the British people were allowed to know or not know as the war against Egypt progressed. Such an act makes alive the idea that a police action was going down. Behind the scenes, Eden was certainly treating this police action like a proper war. He had already ensured that the regular newsreels would tell the story which he wanted told, a fact we'll come back to, but which YouTube can testify to even now. Moviegoers in Britain would be greeted to these newsreels before the film began, and newsreels remained favourable to watching the news on TV, since TVs were still in their infancy and the larger newsreels had better budgets. Yet at the same time, because newsreels were built to last, they were often not designed to bring breaking news. This task was still the mission of the newspapers. In spite of the revolution in media since the century began, the 1950s were a weird kind of limbo, where the new inventions like the television were developing, but had not yet come into their own, as TV famously would during the Vietnam War. Thus, the radio and newspaper remained tools of primary importance to the Prime Minister, and it was deeply frustrating for him when he discovered that the newspaper proprietors and the BBC were reluctant, and then refused, to fall in line. James Cameron's earlier act of defiance was an example of the journalist trying to get to the bottom of things, rather than being told what to say or think. It was especially unfortunate for Eden, because the British press began as defiant and angered by Nasser's nationalisation by July 1956, but by the time action was actually taken here, a majority were against the military manoeuvres. The French government was a bit more open to the idea of letting the newspapers speak their minds, at first, anyway. It was naively assumed in Guy Millet's circle that the French press would support the government and would not jeopardise the war effort by printing derogatory or contrarian views on the war. When it was discovered that the newspapers would not fall in line by default, the French government surged into high gear with incredible results. The editor of the anti-Suez newspaper, L'Express, was called up as a reservist, which actually was quite a clever way to deal with the problem, while Le Monde, another anti-war organ, was placed under intense financial pressure when it was forced to increase its prices by a government ruling, and many of its readership dropped off. Countless other examples could be found in the French government's activity in the sphere of suppressing the news, but in Britain these efforts were not wholly successful, even with Eden's frayed nerves and angry demands. The headlines of some papers thus make for startling reading. The Economist referred to a strange union of cynicism and hysteria in government. The Spectator warned of a terrible indictment that Eden would face when all of this was over. The Observer spoke of the folly and crookedness inherent in Eden's policy, adding the catchy headline that not since 1783 has Britain made herself so universally disliked. The Manchester Guardian, always anti-war as seen during its 1914 coverage, urged readers to protest to their MPs about what was going down and to ask for more information and transparency. Even The Times, so long the establishment voice, was now asking for a way out of the crisis and suggesting that compromise was the way forward. Yet it would be a mistake to consider all the British or French populations to be violently anti-war. A sizeable chunk of the country still favoured Eden's line and liked what they saw in an Anglo-French action independent of American blessing. It was only when it became clear how important such a blessing was that the different peers and segments of the population became agitated. There was precious little information available, not just what the members of the United Nations were saying about Britain, for instance, but also what Eden's government actually wanted. Indeed, it was difficult for Eden himself to know what to do next. He had given a speech of his own over the radio and on television on the 3rd of November, where he had attempted to turn his personal quest against Nasser into a kind of national emergency. His speech was at least well written, and it did impress his pre-existing admirers with his declaration that, "All my life, I have been a man of peace, working for peace, striving for peace, negotiating for peace. I could not be other, even if I wished." Knowing what we know about what Eden had done, was doing, and continued to do to undermine any prospect of peace and torpedo negotiations, though, this apparently sincere claim was virtually empty. Indeed, by the time Eden was making this speech, he would already have been aware that the United Nations General Assembly was attempting to force his hand, operating in the limbo between the expiration of the Anglo-French ultimatum and the actual arrival of Anglo-French forces on the 5th of November. Feverish diplomacy had taken place on a very public forum in a bid to defuse the situation before any actual soldiers were committed, and the Suez crisis went even further out of hand. At the head of these missions were the Canadians, a fact we learned last time, and these were led by Lester Pearson, Canadian Foreign Secretary, later a winner of the Nobel Peace Prize and Prime Minister in the 1960s. It was fortunate that a man like Lester Pearson was at hand to traverse the fears and suspicions of the Anglo-French, combat the outrage of the Americans, and explain the situation to, well, everyone else. At all times, Pearson attempted to present Canada as representing a kind of third way in the United Nations, but one which would give the British and French a sympathetic ear, and which would direct policy sincerely and solely through the United Nations. Pearson was insistent that now that the matter had developed to this extent, back-channel communications would not do. It was high time that the United Nations was used for the purpose it had been created for, that it was actually viewed as the force for good and for peace, the international institution which was consulted when nobody else was apparently able to fix the problem. Think of the United Nations as that person you task with untangling your headphones or necklaces when they need it most. As Pearson himself put it, Canada advised the United Kingdom that at all costs there should be no division of opinion on policy between Washington, London, and Paris, and that no action should be taken by anybody which could not be justified under the United Nations Charter. Otherwise, a country taking that action, no matter how friendly to us, would be hauled before the United Nations and charged by the country against which the action had been taken. We tried to talk this over with our friends before it happened. Since the Anglo-French action was most definitely not justified under the UN Charter, despite what Eden and Selwyn Lloyd liked to claim, Pearson knew that he had his work cut out for him. Above all, he would have to tread carefully when talking about what their British cousins had done. I do not for one minute criticise the motives of the governments of the United Kingdom and France in intervening in Egypt at this time, Pearson said, adding, I may have thought that their intervention was not wise, but I do not criticise their purposes. There was a deep concern and anxiety among the Canadians and several other delegations that this latest police action could lead to another conflagration and escalation, as the Korean War had done only a couple of years before. While claims that the Soviets were planning to scoop up Egypt en route to their domination of the Mediterranean were unfounded, the Soviets were far from inactive, as the destruction of Budapest, from early in the morning of the 4th of November onwards, demonstrated. As we alluded to earlier, though, it was by the 2nd of November that unanimous approval for a ceasefire was gained in the UN General Assembly. Such a strong message could not be ignored in London or Paris. The 2nd of November resolution had urged that all parties now involved in hostilities in the area agree to an immediate ceasefire and, as part thereof, halt the movement of military forces and arms into the sea. It had urged the parties to the armistice agreements promptly to withdraw all forces behind the armistice lines, to desist from raids across the armistice lines into neighbouring territory, and to observe scrupulously the provisions of the armistice agreements. It also recommended that no military goods be introduced into the area by any member state, and added a further plea that upon the ceasefire being effective, steps should be taken to reopen the Suez Canal and restore freedom of navigation. One should spare a thought for Pearson Dixon, the British ambassador to the United Nations, who had been caught off guard several times since the crisis truly began on the 29th of October. Eden's way of working meant that several people remained out of the loop during the high points of the crisis, but the Prime Minister has no excuse for leaving Dixon out of the loop, since it would be Dixon that would have to answer for his country's policy before his UN peers. It must have been mortifying to have learned second-hand about several key developments of the crisis, including from the very beginning the simple fact that an ultimatum was to be issued to the Israelis and Egyptians. So out of the loop was Dixon that he was informed of this ultimatum development by the Russian delegate, who drew his and the attentions of his peers towards it. Facing personalities and challenges like these, Canada's Lester Pearson had to be immensely sensitive to people's feelings. It would do no good, for example, to rub Pearson Dixon's lack of information in his face. Lester Pearson thus described his negotiating style. Instead of indulging then or since in gratuitous condemnation, we expressed our regret and we began to pursue a policy, both here by diplomatic talks and diplomatic correspondence, and later at the United Nations, which would bring about peace in the area on terms which everyone would accept. Our policy then, in carrying out these principles, was to get the United Nations into the matter at once, to seek, through the United Nations, a solution which would be satisfactory to all sides. It is my task to negotiate you guys through the muddy waters of the first week of November, where, by its end, Britain and France had stood down, ceasefire was in place, and a UN emergency force, courtesy of Canadian diplomacy, was on the way. All this during a time when a great number of other things were happening as well. So let's have a look at this week. We need to look at the 1st of November to detect the beginnings of an important trend in the crisis. It was in the House of Commons at 6 p.m. GMT that Anthony Eden stood up to present the crisis to his peers. As was his tactic, Eden presented his policy as one which had been pursued for the benefit of all, and indicated that, in fact, Britain had not been overjoyed at the prospect of intervention, and furthermore, if someone would only take this exercise off our hands, we'd be happy to let them. Eden attempted to do several things at once during the course of this speech, but above all, he knew that by saying such things, he wasn't going to lose anything. On the 1st of November, nobody possessed enough forces on the ground to bring about peace between the Israelis and Egyptians. Only the British and French did. This was about to change. Lester Pearson would make sure of that. What Eden actually said during his speech was, "The first and urgent task is to separate the combatants and stabilize the position. That is our purpose. If the United Nations was then willing to take over the physical task of maintaining peace in that area, nobody would be better pleased than we. But police action there must be to separate the combatants and prevent a resumption of hostilities." Thousands of miles away, Lester Pearson had only finished a meeting with his own peers in Ottawa, wherein it was essentially agreed that some kind of emergency task force should be sent. Once Pearson learned of this gauntlet, which Eden had effectively thrown down, he saw it as something of a sign, or a challenge, or perhaps both. If the British Prime Minister was clearly up for a task force to solve the crisis, then the greatest stumbling block to its establishment was already out of the way. But we may be tempted to ask a question, that being, why did Canada's Foreign Secretary care so much about the crisis? We saw in the previous episode that Lester Pearson was well respected and exceptionally talented when it came to diplomacy, and that he understood how sometimes bewildering institutions like the United Nations worked. That's great then, he may be fluent in the UN language, but that didn't mean that it was axiomatic that he would involve his country and his own considerable energies in getting the crisis solved. In actual fact, while the Suez crisis may appear far beyond the interests of Canadian policy, the reality was much more complex. Post-war Canada had lent enthusiastic support to those institutions which sprang up in the aftermath of the war in the late 1940s. Entities like the United Nations, NATO, and even the Western European Union were all viewed as important in the minds of Canadian statesmen because they all served a specific purpose, They kept the United States and United Kingdom together, and they prevented Canada from ever having to choose one or the other in world affairs. Thus, the Suez Crisis was so problematic to Canadian statesmen precisely because it threw a wrench between the Anglo-American partnership on a scale not yet seen. This, of course, is why the Suez Crisis is so interesting to us, and why Eden's actions can still cause one to scratch their head from time to time. But Lester Pearson, as the Foreign Secretary, or Minister for External Affairs in the Canadian lingo, he was not interested in the motives behind Eden's decision to put still more strain on poor old Eisenhower's heart. He was far more interested in solving these problems before matters escalated. In a sense, the Suez Crisis was the moment when several years of Canadian foreign policy culminated. It was very fortunate that it did, and the United Nations was very fortunate to have a man like Lester Pearson so enthusiastically in their corner. From the late 1940s, Lester Pearson had doggedly searched for support from friendly governments for the establishment of a permanent police force, which the United Nations would control. Nobody was interested, though, since it would mean too many expenses, and the Soviets vetoed the idea anyway. Pearson was miffed, but he did not give up. Canadians were brought into the Korean War through a bill passed in mid-August 1950, but unlike other governments who contributed troops, the bill didn't refer to only the Korean theater. Instead, the bill approved the Canadian government volunteering troops for general UN service. This difference was critical because it meant that even after the Korean War was over, by summer 1953 with their eyes on the Middle East, Canadian policymakers could point to looming crises there and offer their soldiers as part of a wider force to keep the peace in the region. It was hoped that by keeping the Canadian contribution always on something of a standby status, other governments would appreciate the flexibility and value this. Again, we are faced with the question of why the Canadian government cared enough about the Middle East to keep men on standby, and once again the answer boils down to the Anglo-American alliance. Preventing crises from flaring up in the Middle East, especially over the Israeli question, was a top priority for Ottawa and its active foreign secretary. By keeping a lid on such crises, the so-called Atlantic Triangle between Britain, America, and Canada could be maintained and strengthened without fuss. Should anything troubling happen, though, Canada could be caught in a difficult position. Then, of course, in autumn 1956, the Suez Crisis erupted, and Canada found itself in that nightmarish situation which its government had always strove to avoid. This bit of background places Canadian security and policy concerns in context, but it also helps us appreciate that the proposal from Lester Pearson for a UN emergency force did not come out of nowhere. Pearson had been nursing this idea for several years, and Suez gave him the best opportunity yet to follow through with it. As was his wont, Pearson travelled from Ottawa to New York for the UN meeting later in the day of the 1st of November. He arrived in time to take part in the first of many all-night UN General Assembly sessions, which ran through the night of the 1st to 2nd of November. While there, he saw John Foster Dulles, American Secretary of State, and immensely peeved at Anglo-French behaviour by this stage. Dulles tabled a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire and the withdrawal from all hostile forces out of Egypt. Since it was not legally binding, Eden could ignore it, and he did for the moment, but Lester Pearson offered his own 2 cents on the proposal which Dulles had put forward, arguing that peace is far more than ceasing fire. Lester Pearson actually laid down some criticism onto John Foster Dulles for requesting peace without proposing any solutions to the situation on the ground. Pearson then alluded to a more useful solution. Why not take advantage of the rhetoric which had been used by the British earlier in that day and take Eden up on his offer to supply some kind of UN international force to the region? Dulles liked the idea and didn't seem to take Pearson's criticisms personally. He was a consummate professional himself. By now, it was early in the morning of the 2nd of November, and there were many other things to discuss, so Dulles said that Pearson should work on some kind of draft report on the topic, which they could together debate, and Pearson set to work doing just that. Building on all the things he had learned, and pulling together all the things he hoped that the international force would be. Later in the day of the 3rd of November, Pearson had his first draft ready, but while he had been working on it, another development in diplomacy had taken place which convinced him further that this was the correct course of action. In the early afternoon of the 3rd of November, the UN Secretary-General reported to the General Assembly that the governments of the UK and France had informed him that they would most willingly stop military action as soon as three conditions had been satisfied, which were then laid out. First, Egyptian and Israeli acceptance of a UN force to keep the peace. Second, constitution and maintenance of such a force until an Arab-Israeli peace settlement had been reached and satisfactory arrangements regarding the Suez Canal had been agreed to. And third, acceptance by both parties of the stationing of limited detachments of Anglo-French forces until the UN force was constituted. While these conditions were not acceptable to the General Assembly, they did suggest to Pearson in strong terms that joint UN action in the form of some kind of peacekeeping force will be acceptable to the British, French, and even Americans. What a convenient thing, then, that Pearson had his draft resolution detailing how just such a force would be created, ready in his hot little hands. Pearson put this proposal to the General Assembly floor. By law, don't forget, governments in the UN General Assembly did not have to abide by anything that was decided upon or recommended in the General Assembly. Yet, Lester Pearson's draft resolution calling for what would become known as the UN Emergency Force was one of those few resolutions. It was not legally, only morally binding. And yet, it didn't just carry the day in the Assembly, it also compelled the member states to actually follow its tenets. Pearson's proposal was adopted by the General Assembly early in the morning of the 4th of November, and later that day, the Secretary-General submitted his first report on its contents. In the meantime, the members of the General Assembly, no doubt unsure of what time it was by this stage, were notified of the arrival of some communiques from London and Paris. The Anglo-French communiques indicated that the two governments wished to stop military action, provided that the United Nations decides to constitute and maintain such a force, and Israel and Egypt agreed to accept the force to keep the peace, and in the meantime, to accept forthwith limited detachments of Anglo-French forces to be stationed between the combatants. Now that Pearson's emergency force resolution had been given tacit conditional approval by the Anglo-French and overwhelming approval by the member states, with some 26 members pledging forces in the end, it had only to be made into UN law. When the Secretary-General presented his first report on Pearson's resolution later in the afternoon of the 4th of November, it was proposed that another Canadian, Major General E.L.M. Burns, Chief of Staff of the UN Truce Supervision Organization, would lead it as Chief of Command of a UN force. The report also outlined a plan for recruiting staff and additional officers. These suggestions were approved by the following day in the General Assembly in its resolution of the 5th of November, which established a United Nations Command for an Emergency International Force to secure and supervise the cessation of hostilities in accordance with all the terms of the General Assembly resolution of the 2nd of November, 1956. I know there's a lot of facts and details to wrap your heads around in all of this, but all these developments really meant was that Pearson's UN Emergency Force resolution was based in part on John Foster Dulles' earlier proposal, which had called for a ceasefire. What this meant was that the UN and the United States may well pressure the British and French to make peace with the Egyptians before Anglo-French forces properly attacked. Now, this was a critical problem for Eden, because he knew full well that the preliminary attacks launched by British and French paratroopers were supposed to begin early in the morning of the 5th of November, with the full front of the assault following the next day. Such complications help us to explain why, in the background of these efforts to set up this emergency force, the British and French abstained in voting. Indeed, as this stellar negotiating was underway in the first few days of November 1956, Anthony Eden was doing his level best to continue with the plan that nobody seemed to want anymore. The Canadians were entrenched firmly on the moral high ground, and while Lester Pearson was friendly to Britain, it was clear that he would not now let his emergency force brainchild go. What did this mean for the Anglo-French Expeditionary Force, which was sending its first men into Egypt from the air by the time the finishing touches were placed on Pearson's resolution? Well, it meant that Britain and its Prime Minister were about to look very silly indeed once again. This was all the worse for Eden because Pearson had not stayed within his UN bubble while devising the scheme. he was loud enough about it that members of the opposition in the House of Commons, and, Eden suspected, some of his own backbenchers and cabinet ministers, favoured the scheme as a handy way out. Eden, if you had asked him a week before, would have spat that he didn't want a handy way out. He wanted to crush President Nasser, and to crush him yesterday. Now though, as the 4th of November became the 5th of November, and Eden imagined the piles of bad press which continued to accumulate daily, he wasn't so sure anymore. Within a few hours he would be given further bad news. Anglo-French paratroopers had made contact with the Egyptians, but when given the chance, the Egyptians had not offered an unconditional surrender. Yet another breathtaking plank in Eden's plan had been shattered. He had expected the inferior Egyptian armed forces to crumble under the onslaught of the Entente, and now that they had not, it meant that a nearly instantaneous victory would not be in the Anglo-French possession, and they would have to land the full extent of the expedition over the next few days. The longer this ordeal went on, though, the worse it made Eden look. It was decision time. Could he exit the crisis better off than before? Could he gain anything from the crisis at all? Eden did not seem to be at the stage quite yet when he was asking the right questions. What he should have been more concerned with was whether those he had inconvenienced, those he had stressed out and frustrated, would allow him to exit with his credibility still in one piece. The longer this ordeal went on, the angrier President Eisenhower became. Next time, we'll see exactly what this anger made the President of the United States do to his one-time friend and ally. Until then though, my lovely history friends and patrons, my name is Zach, and this has been 1956 episode 2.16. Thanks so much for listening and supporting this show, and I'll be seeing you all soon.